Welcome to this year's Holy Week Lenten Reflections. Our guest this evening is Father John McDate, Principal of Heathrop College, University of London. This is John's third visit to Malta. Once he was invited for a Christian Life Community seminar, and a few years later he was asked to address the Maltese clergy during their annual theological seminar. John entered the Jesuit novitiate in 1964 and read philosophy, modern languages, education, and obtained a doctorate in theology at New College, University of Edinburgh. Since 1985, he has lectured in systematic theology at Heathrop College, and for many years was editor of The Month, a review of Christian thought and world affairs. In the year 2000, he was appointed principal of Heathrop College, University of London. John published many articles on a range of social, religious, and theological areas. I am sure John's reflections will help us to go deeper in the mysteries that we are contemplating and celebrating this week. Ladies and gentlemen, I pass the word to Reverend Dr. John McDade.
Thank you for the invitation, Father Jimmy, and thank you to you for coming this evening. I was very happy to accept this invitation for various reasons. First of all, this morning in Gatwick Airport in London, there was snow on the ground, and I wanted to come someplace warm. Secondly, I wanted to find out if it's true that Maltese don't drive on the left of the road or the right, but drive in the middle or in the shade. That's, so I wanted to test that. And thirdly, it's because I've always liked Maltese people. So it's a great pleasure to be among you, among this group. It's very strange and very bold on my part to come to Malta to talk about Catholicism. You surely have enough Catholicism in Malta. I mean, this would be one of the places that people would look to and say, well, if you want to know what Catholic life is like, go to Malta. For good or for ill. And I'm concerned about this because I come from a Catholic context too. I mean, one of my theories is that Catholicism in Europe is always a series of subcultures within a dominant culture. The great thing about being a Catholic is you can live in a wider culture and you can know that that whole culture is wrong because you are right. There's this profound sense of having the truth and being surrounded by people who don't have the truth. And the experience of liberalism is normally not one that Catholics take to very easily. We really make very bad liberals, and I'll be reflecting on that. But the other reason, and it's a serious reason, in the past 30 years, we have seen the collapse of Catholic cultures within one generation. In different parts of the world. French Canada, Holland, Belgium, what's happening in Ireland just now, a very, very painful process. And it's as though, and it's hard to put this in an optimistic way, it's as though you can have a Catholic culture, but its roots might actually be very shallow. And once certain social changes happen, you suddenly find that a culture where the church was a natural, formative part of people's lives, accepted, influential, something that people identified with, within a period of 10 years, something happens and the people move away from that unforced allegiance to the church. Now, it's not for me to say what your experience is, but the reason I think it's interesting to reflect on Catholicism is because, in a sense, we need to try and keep being attentive to what it means to be Catholic at the deepest sense, because my fear is that a lot of the time what we have seen are versions of Catholicism that looked and felt strong, but in fact turned out to be very fragile and very weak and unable to negotiate the social and cultural changes that will happen wherever you are. So that's what I want to try and do with you in the next couple of days, try and offer you some reflections on this. And I want to begin this evening by introducing some of the ideas associated with a Swiss theologian. It won't be too technical. A Swiss theologian called Hans Urs von Balthasar. And as I came in this evening, I noticed some books by him on sale on the little bookshelf. The reason he's important is because in the 1980s, he was part of a group involving some of the major theologians in the Catholic Church at that time, among whom was Joseph Ratzinger. Now, whatever happened to Joseph Ratzinger? Hans Urs von Balthasar was said to be the favorite theologian of Pope John Paul II. And with Cardinal Ratzinger moving to the Congregation for the Faith, and John Paul II in 1979 becoming Pope, the kind of Balthasarian view of theology and the Church came right to the very heart of Catholicism. It's been a very influential model. And I want to introduce some of his ideas to you about the Church. I want to begin with a quotation from an Irish writer who just died 10 days ago. He's the generation just above me. He died aged about 72, and he wrote a wonderful memoir of growing up in Ireland as a very devout young man wanting to be a priest with a wonderful relationship between himself and a very holy woman who was his mother. By the end of his life, he gets condemned by the Catholic Church and moves away from Christian faith. And at the end of the memoir that he writes, he has this powerful statement. Through the violent history of Catholicism run the two dividing movements. The fortress churches with their edicts, threats and punishments. And the churches of the spires and brilliant windows that go towards love and light. In McGahan's experience, what he longed for, what he treasured, was the second one. And what he discovered was the first one. And he was unable to put together the two of these things. And that's part of the internal contradictions or tensions within Catholicism, capable of astonishing power of spiritual and moral and personal inspiration, producing wonderful examples of human goodness and holiness. And yet, the other side experienced as somehow coming across to people as being against them, as being oppressive, as being somehow not in keeping with the best instincts in humanity. Now, I'm wondering whether this is part of the kind of experience that Catholics need to reflect on. Another one of these. I'm very interested in slightly lapsed Catholics. There's a term they're using in England now. People are called cultural Catholics. Do you know this term? There are many Jesuits who are cultural Catholics. You know, where little. This is another one, Terry Eagleton, a literary critic, a very brilliant literary critic with a wonderful sense of what the truth of Christianity is, but himself slightly at a distance, but like many people at a distance, he's raising his children as Catholics. I always find very interesting. The boy who first revealed to me the facts of life was clearly a Protestant, since he seemed to have read a little scripture. Catholics didn't do this. As the hair-raising news of human reproduction assaulted my scandalized ear, I resorted to the only defense available to me. Well, I rounded on him, maybe that's how Protestants do it. It's a bit like that story about the boy who asks his mother, where did I come from? And mother says, well, daddy and I found you under a gooseberry bush in the garden. Where did you come from, mummy? Well, grandma and grandpa found me under a gooseberry bush in the garden. And where did grandma come from? Well, her mummy and daddy found her under a gooseberry bush in the garden. So he goes to school the next day and says to his teacher, You know, there hasn't been a normal birth in our family for 3 generations. No. Blaise Pascal, the great 17th century writer, a saint in my opinion, deeply opposed to the Jesuits. Therefore, very holy man. In his Pensée, this little collection of writings, he has this very, very acute, sharp little statement. The Pope is head. Who else is known by all? Who else is recognized by all, with the power to infiltrate the whole body, because he holds the main branch which infiltrates everywhere? How easy it would have been for this to degenerate into tyranny. That is why Christ gave them this commandment. But it shall not be so with you. Remember, the Gentiles lord it over their subjects. But it shall not be so with you. And for Pascal, the one thing that prevents the Catholic Church becoming tyranny is the instruction of Christ about the way in which authority is to be exercised. Now, von Balthasar, this modern theologian, he's preoccupied with the issue of why Catholics hate the papacy. He offers a theological reflection on the deep-seated anti-Roman attitude among Catholics, an evident contest within the Church itself, mostly against the Petrine principle. And he presses the Church to examine the bias in its nature against its central focus of authority. Now, it seems to me that a lot of Catholic commentators over the past 40 years since the Second Vatican Council have been deeply anti-Petrine. And they've often promoted a version of Catholicism in ways that want to diminish or eradicate papal authority in any strong sense. And this, of course, has been countered by another position that wants to define Catholicism very strongly, with a great emphasis on Petrine and papal authority. And the result has been that what you've seen, this is my experience in the past 40 years, this sometimes terrible polarization within the Catholic Church, that groups are unable to speak to one another because there is this contest, and the contest centers on the place of authority, how it's to be exercised, and how people are to deal with authority relating to them. For example, it's often not just a question of how authority behaves. It's often how authority is received. And that's part of von Balthasar's concern. It takes two to tango, but it only takes one partner to mess up the dance. And it can be either the person in authority or the person under authority. And that's why Catholicism's often problematic. Let me ask you this question. You can see there's no clear answer to this. I would have given you an answer. When does the Church begin? Are there any Catholics here? Anyone been baptized? When does the Church begin? What would be your answer to that? What do I mean by begin? Have you been doing philosophy? When does the Church start? Someone said the cross, Pentecost, with the gift of the Holy Spirit. That would give you a view of the Church as filled by the Holy Spirit and sent on mission to the whole of the Gentile world. The Annunciation, that it begins with the faith of Mary, receiving the Son of God into her body and giving birth to him. The Last Supper, when Christ gives his own body to the Church as its life, with Pentecost again, yeah. I sense a lot of disagreement within the Maltese Church here. You don't know when the Church begins. Your baptism. So the Church begins again every baptism. The recreation of the Church. You can actually answer this in different ways. I mean, you could say it's when Jesus calls his disciples, or when he sends them out on mission. There's an old answer, and I won't give you this, I won't spend any time on this one. The answer given by St. Augustine and St. Thomas was that the Church begins with Abel, the son of Adam and Eve, who is killed by Cain for making an offering to God, and who was a shepherd. And for Augustine, the church begins at the very beginning of humanity. Now, that's a very interesting notion, because it means you have the church before Christ. And that's got all kinds of universal significances. But the position that von Balthasar takes, and it's a very interesting one, is the one that you gave. He takes the view that the church begins at the Annunciation. Now, what's the consequence of this? It means that before you have the giving of authority to some by Jesus, before you have the call of the 12, before you have the pastoral office being given and the teachings of Jesus, you have a realization of the church in the person of Mary, who embodies the church. She is, if you like, the body image of the church, receiving the Son of God in her mind and heart so completely that she conceives him in her womb. The fathers of the church always thought of the Annunciation and the conception of Christ as an act of faith. It begins with Mary's mind and heart being so completely open to God that she can receive the very self-expression of God that is Christ. And she is sanctified by this presence and then gives this presence to the world. And in that way she represents the church. Now Balthasar's going to take this line, and it's a very interesting line, because what it enables you to do is to have a different image of the church itself. Now let me suggest to you that if you are born in my generation, maybe your generation too, your instinctive model of the church will be something like a pyramid, an empty pyramid, with a pope at the top. Any idea what's going to come next? Cardinals. I bet you won't get the next one. You think it's going to be bishops, don't you? No, it's not going to be no archbishops. Curial officials. An English bishop told me once that he was having a discussion with the curial, particular curia in the Vatican, and one of the curial officials said to him, "But you're only a bishop." He was furious with this. Furious. And then bishops. Then it gets very interesting. What's going to come after this? Where would we be without them? Where are we going next? Eucharistic ministers? Religious or lay people? Readers? Sacristans. Now these are very powerful people. Very powerful. I was tempted to put in housekeepers. Boy altar servers. Girl altar servers. There's a contest there, isn't there? And finally, laity. Now, I want to suggest to you that somehow that's often the way it feels. With everything being structured so that there's this weight that presses down, at the very bottom you have the laity. Now, von Balthasar is very unhappy with this, very unhappy, because he says, this is the kind of model that's a legacy of Imperial Rome and a reaction to the encroachments of medieval emperors. He thinks that this kind of practical model is actually, it doesn't belong within the church's reality, but it's a model that the church has developed for historical reasons. And it's a distortion. And so what he tries to do is he wants to speak of the multidimensional reality of the church. Don't define the church by one thing. It's going to have different dimensions, and your account of the church needs to keep these dimensions together. He also thinks that there are more fundamental tensions in the church than between, for example, monarchy and democracy. Very often in the way people comment on the post-Vatican II church, it's suggested that there's this tension between a monarchical government and a more democratic participation. Now, what's interesting for Van Balthem, you'll see this as we have a look at this, he thinks that there are actually tensions built into the church. You are never going to have a tension-free church. And that's not because it's the way people are. He's going to say the church is actually structured in such a way, God acts on it in such a way, that these different dimensions must stand in a certain tension with one another. Okay? So you will not produce a tension-free church. If you do, it will not be the Church of Christ. Okay? So you cannot eliminate these tensions. But it's a question of how you characterize them, and how you handle them, and how you think of them relating to one another. Okay? Now that's what Van Balthasar is going to try and do. And I want to give you a sense of how he does this. What Van Balthasar does, and it's a very simple way of thinking of the different dimensions in the church. What he does is he takes the figures around Jesus in the New Testament, and he identifies them with particular aspects that belong in the church. Each of them symbolizes something. This is what he calls the constellation of figures around Jesus. And what he's going to suggest is that you can think of the church as composed of this constellation of figures, each of whom represents a founding principle in the church, a dimension that must be there because it belongs within the sets of relationships that Christ establishes. Okay, well, let's take a little example. The first one to take is Peter, not because we're giving a particular importance to Peter over anyone else, as you'll see, but what would you associate with Peter? Well, there are two images in the New Testament that are classically attached to Peter. One is Peter as the rock on which Christ builds the church. We'll be looking at that image in more detail tomorrow. The other is shepherd. How many times did Peter deny Christ? Three times. When Christ appears to the disciples after the resurrection, he asks Peter the same question three times. Do you love me? And what does he then tell Peter to do? Feed my sheep. Feed my lambs. So Peter could be taken to represent pastoral office. It is his responsibility to be the shepherd and to lay down his life in the way in which the good shepherd laid down his life. The 12. What would you take the 12 apostles to represent? First of all, why are they 12? Because it's the refounding of Israel. It's the 12 tribes that are being reconstituted. The 12 are also given authority, just as Peter is. For Van Balthasar, they represent collegiality. So in other words, right at the very beginning, you have an authority given to Peter, but you also have an authority given to the 12. And these two must stand in relationship with one another. So you cannot have a papacy that works independently of collegiality, Van Balthasar is saying. He's also saying to the bishops, you cannot have a collegiality unless you're connected to Peter. So these two things have to work together. But he also very deliberately draws attention to the fact that Judas is part of this circle. I think in Malta you've probably been hearing about all these stories about the Gospel of Judas. Just when we thought that the Da Vinci Code was finished, you know, this next nightmare comes along. A little remark on this. People have known for centuries of the existence of what are called apocryphal gospels. written in the second and third century. I've got a collection of them in my office at Heathrop. Gospel of Philip, the Gospel of Thomas, the Gospel of Peter, etc. They're generally taken to be late claims to secret traditions, which are presented as coming from particular apostles. And the best comment on this latest one of the Gospel of Judas, made by a New Testament scholar in Aberdeen, who said, "It's of no significance at all. It's a bit like coming across a speech by Queen Victoria in which she spoke about her CD collection." Okay, the ideas are kind of put back. Now, von Balthasar pays particular attention to the fact that Judas is in the 12, and also that he is the one associated with betrayal. And he says very strongly, the reality of the church is that there will always be an aspect of betrayal. And he points out very strongly that the figure of Peter is very close to the figure of Judas. Judas betrayed Christ, and Peter denied Christ three times. So in answer to the question, why is there this unease often in the Catholic Church about the relationship of the papacy to the rest of the church, Balthasar says it's because Peter is chosen as a weak individual, close to Judas. And it's the Lord's will that this pastoral office should be exercised by one who is unfit for it. I think we've had a remarkable series of papacies in my lifetime. Quite remarkable, quite exceptional, for the quality of teaching, the quality of holiness, just exceptional witness being given from the papacy. You don't need me to tell you it has not always been like that. Okay? But we cope with it. And in part what von Balthasar is saying is, recognize that that aspect is always going to be there. Now, what he's doing then, he's building up a complex of different things that operate in the church. So you have John the Baptist, for example, representing, well, the last of the prophets from Judaism, but also prophetic martyrdom. This principle of clear challenge in the name of God to those who are disobeying God's commandments. And that aspect must be there within the community that Christ founds. The beloved disciple in the Gospel of John, the one whom Jesus loves, and the one who reclines on the bosom of Jesus at the Last Supper. I don't know if you've seen, there are medieval sculptures and paintings of this, of the beloved disciple resting his head on the bosom of Christ. Very, very powerful image of discipleship, not as an active thing, but as a contemplative thing, that the disciple is one with his Lord in a personal relationship of love. And that must be there, because without that, Christianity is always in danger of becoming a system. But it's the principle of love and contemplation. Von Balthasar points out that in the story of one of the appearances in the Gospel of John, when Peter is rehabilitated with that threefold question, the question that he's asked is, "Do you love me?" And it's that Peter is being called to connect with this dimension of love and contemplation. In other words, pastoral office needs to pay attention to what it means to be a loving disciple of the Lord. It's a corrective, but it's also a deepening of what the papal office in the church is meant to be. Nicodemus, very interesting little figure. The one who comes to Jesus by night, presumably because he is afraid. The one who is uncertain the one who is a searcher. And the community must always be able to have within itself the sense of people who are not there yet, but who want to be connected. You've always got to keep the boundaries of the church ragged. It's actually very bad for a Catholic church to have so strict boundaries that it becomes a community of the righteous. It needs to have, in my opinion, it needs to have a very strong centre, because only if it has a very strong centre can it have ragged edges that can encompass people. And that's the tension of Catholicism. I've got no interest in producing or creating a liberalised Catholicism without any edge to it. Because I do think that what we need is a strong Catholicism at its centre, but a strong Catholicism that is able to have the different dimensions of humanity within it. Equally, outsiders. Very, very strong theme of the ministry of Jesus. His concern for those who are non-observant, and his deliberate incorporation of the non-observant within the community that meets together. And somehow the Catholic Church has a genius for this, but it needs to keep reminding itself all the time that it must be a place for the sinners and the weak. It must be. And it must never create a kind of church culture in which that dimension is eliminated. Remember what Van Balthasar is doing in all this? He is looking at the founding principles of the church. So these are not in addition to the church. These are the component parts that make up the church. And you can see that some are strong principles of great holiness. Some are terrible principles to do with betrayal. Some are principles to do with weakness. Some are strong principles of witness. That's our community. Children. Interesting in the Gospels, the Synoptic Gospels, the role given to the child as welcoming the kingdom of heaven, and the children who on Palm Sunday welcome the Lord into Jerusalem. The role, I think, of children representing the unlettered, both those who are unable to read, but also those who in different ways are handicapped. They have their place. And there's a very strong emphasis in the Gospels that it's not the learned and the clever who know the mysteries of the kingdom, but it's the unlettered to whom God enlightens. Martha and Mary. I had an aunt who worked hard all her life, and she could never forgive Jesus for his treatment of Martha. She thought that this was really terrible, that Martha was actually ignored and badly, because she identified with Martha. I mean, some people are natural Marthas. You know, they spend their lives serving others, and with good reason complain that others... I live in a Jesuit community that's full of Marys. Absolutely, full of them. You know, when a toilet roll is finished, they leave the empty thing there. What did your last servant die of? What do these represent? The domestic church, hospitality, the way in which, in the conditions of an ordinary family life, something is done to extend hospitality that is a hospitality to Christ. The sign of a healthy Catholic church is one in where the home is a hospitable home, especially to the poor and the needy. Okay? We've got to be very careful the way in which our homes are turning into fortresses of selfishness. Okay? I'm not talking about your thing, your context here. But the homes are often places where people get away from the rest of the world. But, you know, There's this tradition of the hospitality to be given to strangers. Very important. The women at the tomb. Very interesting. The scholars tell us that in the time of Jesus, the time of the New Testament, in Jewish law, women were not allowed to act as witnesses because their witness was regarded as unreliable, because they gossiped too much. They did not have the status of legitimate witnesses. Now, in that context, does it matter that the first witnesses to the resurrection are women? Indeed it does. Because these are the ones who bear the witness to the rest of the church. And in all the discussions about the roles of women in the church, the foundational role, I think, is generating the resurrection faith of the church. And women have been doing this since the very beginning. It's never been visibly structured, nor in a sense can it be. Indeed, one of the reasons Van Balthasar is doing this is because he wants to draw attention to the fact that there are some principles in the church that are highly visible and are very powerful and are in danger of overriding other ones. He's very concerned, for example, about the way in which the Petrine principle is so strong a principle, got so many features attached to it, that unless it's very careful, it can obliterate. This is why he's putting out these different aspects as a way of saying, look, if you are church, these are dimensions that need to be there, and they have to find their place, even if they're not visible or powerful in a strong symbolic sense. But the whole business of the role of the women in generating the resurrection faith of the church is extremely important. Foster father of Jesus, representing the dimension of fatherhood and work. Now, I don't know what your experience is here. I think we have a real crisis, a cultural crisis, about how to be a good man. I don't mean a good person. I'm deliberately talking about how to be a good man. Because I think the images of masculinity that our culture is fostering are images that associate masculinity with violence and power and abuse. They're negative images. And if you are a young man growing up, how do you turn into a good man? What does it mean to do that? What does it mean to be a good man? And that's a question of absolutely central significance for women. Because if men can get this right, women's life might be a little bit easier. If there are good men in the world, a lot of women will be very happy. Absolutely. The whole dimension also of fathering and work as a dimension of the church. Now, we've got to be very careful. Islam, seems to me, is a religion for men. Okay. Talking generalizations. Is Christianity a religion for men? You see what I'm getting at? I don't know how to answer this one, but there's a way in which this whole dimension of responsible... Men are good when they're responsible. We go crazy when we're not responsible. We go off the rails. Okay? If you want to get the best out of a man, make him responsible for something. Make him principal of Heathrop or whatever. But that brings the best out in men. Now, there's a whole issue, I think, in Christianity about us fostering the kind of masculinity and fathering roles that is absolutely crucial for the good of society. And I think it's important to recognize this at the moment. Paul. Now, the interesting thing about St. Paul is that Paul is not part of the 12. He is the one raised up by Christ to move the church out of the Jewish matrix, to open up the church to the cultures of the world. I'm even told that he came to Malta. He was as bold as that. And he'd very, very appreciative of the hospitality of the Maltese people. Paul is a dimension, a very important dimension, of adaptation to cultures. There's that wonderful moment in the Acts of the Apostles where he goes to Athens and he says, well, what it says of him is he was appalled by the idolatry of the place. And then he goes to the Areopagus and he says to them, "Men of Athens, I see you are a very religious people," trying to put the best interpretation on a culture that he thinks is got little going for it. And then he has conversations with the Stoics and Epicureans, the intellectual formers of Athenian culture. So he engages in a dialogue with this culture. Instead of condemning it, he tries to find the points of contact where he can make a statement about, "I see you have a thing to the unknown God." And that's the point of contact. He's the one that begins this process of taking the gospel out of the Jewish matrix into the instabilities of the pagan world. James. Now, the deliberate contrast here, because this James, he's the one described in the New Testament as the brother of the Lord. He's not part of the 12, as the Americans say. He comes out of left field after the resurrection. Suddenly, James becomes the leader of the conservative Jewish Christian community in Jerusalem. And remember that for the first 30 years of the church, the central authority in the church is not Paul, it's not Peter, it's James. It's the Jerusalem church that has the focus of authority. He is the one who insists on tradition and law, the connectedness to the Torah of Israel. And you can see that there's a very strong tension between the demands of adaptation and the demands of tradition and law. And Balthasar is saying that is simply built into the church. To complete his picture, at the center of the whole church is Mary, who realizes in herself the quality of being church. She is the body image of the church, characterized by lay holiness. And what Van Balthasar is trying to say is, by contrast with this pyramid, whereby the laity are somehow at the very bottom of everything, it's as though the Marian dimension of the church is the deepest dimension at the heart of everything. You even get a strong statement in the Catechism of the Catholic Church that says the church is more Marian than Petrine. This is what it comes out of. So what Van Balthasar is giving is an account of the church where you have these different dimensions, all of which need to come into play, and at the center of it all is the dimension of lay holiness at the center of the church's life. Open up for a little discussion. What do you make of that? We have a roving microphone, so we can hear the laity.
I find I have a lot to do with young people, mm-hmm. and many of them are searchers. Mm-hmm. And it's beautiful listening to them asking questions, but sometimes they ask too many questions. And I think we need more of the beloved disciple. Yeah. I tell them, you need to, at some stage, you have to stop and say, "All right, let me leave things to God. Mm-hmm. And let me trust in God. Yeah. And accept what I have learnt." Mm, not always ask and ask and ask.
I know. I think there's a lot in that. What it makes me think of is, we have actually taught people that it's easy to talk about God. There's been a whole studies that people do now into what's called the early modern period, the 17th century. What people notice is that that's the time when people begin to construct arguments for the existence of God. That if we have this kind of world, then there must be a God. It's the beginning of modern science. And so Christianity then begins to mount proofs for God marginalizing Jesus Christ, so there's no, he doesn't come into it at all, and marginalizing religious experience. So we teach people to talk about religion, to talk about God, independently of a connection to Christ, and independently of religious experience and the practice of religion. Does that make sense to you? You know, and so as a result, the whole question is often an intellectual question. And I think what you're pointing to, in fact, the key to most progress in understanding is through becoming deeply immersed in the practice of a religion. Now, I'm coming from London at the moment. What I find interesting, I teach Jewish-Christian relations. When we get our students to understand the role of the law in Judaism and how Jewish feasts and ritual in the home is how the faith is transmitted and practiced, they get completely bowled over by the way in which a religion is practiced, because they're coming from a kind of Christianity which has lost its sense of practice. Does that make sense? And equally, what's interesting now is the way in which in Britain, in London, it's the Muslims who practice the religion. And I often point out, Catholics don't say any morning or night prayers anymore, just judging from confessions. Just doesn't seem to. Muslims are the ones who are praying. And I just find that it's an interesting shift that's happening in our faith.
Father John, maybe you can explain to us. In this model by Baldassare, did he put in outsiders, sinners and the weak, yeah, did he incorporate the suffering of the sick and most probably he did. Is that in it?
Absolutely.
Or is it, I mean, another category?
There's a very deliberate decision on the part of Jesus to bring into the body of Israel the non-observant and the unclean. And almost certainly the parable of the prodigal son. The young son, younger brother, represents Israel that leaves aside the practice of the law. And the importance of that parable is that it's the elder brother who has to recognize that the outsiders, the sinners, have as much right to be in the house of the Father as he does.
Yes, what I meant to say also in that category is putting in the lepers and
absolutely,
say the handicapped and all the water.
Absolutely, yes.
And
yes,
all the suffering in the hospitals and the water.
Absolutely, that's taken in, yes, very much so, very much, yeah.
Is there anybody in the constellation around Christ that represents people who want the world to have a better, just, a more just social order, who want society to somehow incarnate the ideas of a better world in a way?
That's a very good question.
Or is it that von Balthasar doesn't like the idea, so he doesn't find a place?
Well, he would probably drive Father Jimmy mad. I think Father Jimmy is very keen on liberation theology, and I think Balthasar wasn't very keen on liberation theology. But it wouldn't exclude that. But you're right, in the kind of description he does, there isn't that prophetic social impulse that we would come to recognize very strongly now as a significant feature of Catholicism over the past 40 years. That wouldn't be there. I think he would say, well, there's actually nobody there who represents it. But of course, Paul, concerned with the quality of culture, quality of life in the world, and so on. But it's a good point to raise. You're right.
With regard to the point just raised, what's missing from von Balthasar's model is Christ.
Yes.
Because Christ, from the Beatitudes, says in Luke, blessed are you poor.
That's right.
Not blessed the poor in spirit. He says, blessed are you poor. So Balthasar Absolutely. Misses out Christ. The second point I want to make, and then I'll stop, is that this is a radically feminine view of the church. If it's fascinating, because what von Balthasar really, if we look at it, the failures are Peter, the 12, Judas. They're the failures. But women are revalorized, so that women are the main witnesses.
Well,
women are the witnesses of the key element of faith, and Mary is at the center. So
they do come out.
It's
come
a feminine church.
Oh yeah, sure. They do come out well in the New Testament. I mean, What you've got to recognize here is that Van Balthasar will say these are different vocations. These are vocations within the church. These are missions within the church. It doesn't mean that everyone has to exemplify all of them. For example, there will be people who, by temperament, are Jamesian, I use that word, for whom the principle of tradition and law is a very strong principle. There will be others, I suppose Jesuit missionaries in China and India in the 17th, 18th century would have been very Pauline in this, and that's part of the tension. Yeah. I hope it's not a feminized church, because I do think one of the interesting things is that this whole Marian principle, Mary is a model for all men and women, because in relation to God, every person must have a dimension of openness, reception, and obedience. And somehow that's, now I don't want to say that's feminine, I don't think it is. I think that's actually, that kind of responsiveness is what it means to be human. And I think men and women are called to do that. Yeah. Sorry, there's a question here. Yeah.
I think it
centers too much on Catholicism,
yeah.
While the church for me is much, much larger, no?
Yeah, yeah.
So
yeah.
Is there no place for ecumenism in this picture and
yes,
other people of other faiths? You know?
Obviously, yes, it would be. This would be the dimensions within the community. It's a kind of symbolic view of the church. Yeah, I hope it's not meant to be unecumenical and I think this whole question of the Pauline dimension, that's the openness to religions and culture, very very strong in contemporary Catholicism, I think. Yeah.
Comparing the two models you've presented to us, what differences do you see in terms of the way the church works and the sort of the structures and the outcomes in comparing the two structures?
Yeah. It's very hard to change operating systems. Okay? It's very hard. Because they have a way of doing what they think is best. The reason I think something like this is important is because if we have that kind of picture of Catholicism, we've got a language for thinking about ourselves differently. You know, so if these are, in fact, foundational principles in the church, then we cannot go back to the pyramid. As though that's, you know, you cannot have popes and bishops and priests telling lay people what lay people are supposed to be doing. There needs to be a deep consultation and listening and collaboration. So I think that's the kind of importance that has. It gives people a different way of thinking about these things. And certainly I think if you put the dimension of lay holiness at the heart of the church, it alters how I operate as a priest. And the Catechism of the Catholic Church is very clear that what ministerial priesthood is to do is to build up the baptismal dignity of the laity. And what that means, say, from my point of view, is I cannot exercise my priestly ministry if I'm not ensuring that the baptismal dignity of lay people is actually being fostered. Now, I think that makes a profound difference. I hope it does. Whether it's any better, I'm not sure. You know, there's an old parish priest in Glasgow who was heard to say, "I'm against all change, especially change for the better." I think he'd been disappointed so many times by promises of change.
If I may, two points, two related points. One is, Which aspect of the church engages the intellect. And the second one, which is follow-up of your statement about the 17th century and the search for the proofs and so on, is that nowadays you seem to get, in a sense, a defense of faith, in the, saying that, look, faith is something different from reason, that we have to look to experience and religious experience, and that therefore we can't speak in terms of proof anymore.
Yeah.
But this is, in my mind, in a sense, a bit of a cop-out.
Sure.
I mean, the modern world wants answers in a way it can understand, and they're saying, look, you're asking these questions, but we have answers to different questions.
Yes.
So we're not engaged in a dialogue in
this way. You're right.
Do you see a way out?
No. No, I think that's our cultural, that's the problem at the moment. I mean, I'm bothered by the way in which what I would call a strongly evangelical voice is becoming the Christian voice. And I do think the Catholic tradition, with its contact with philosophy and rationality and reasoned exploration of things, is a more subtle and nuanced way of handling this. But the media love confrontations between evangelical religion and scientists. I mean, the classic Richard Dawkins business. And of course, the terrible thing about this, these kind of scientific atheists that, like Dawkins, the interesting thing about atheism is what kind of theism is it reacting against? That's the real question. And it's only when you look at that I think you begin to get onto a better discussion level with them. Nobody ever believes the kind of thing that Richard Dawkins doesn't believe in.
No, there's that kind of thing.
Wait. Between this diagram and the earlier one, it's harder to be a lay Christian over here because it involves us. It engages us. I mean, I'm not putting this in a disparaging way. This is why I like it. But because it is like this, it demands much more from the lay Christian.
Yeah.
And somehow I feel that the lay Christian today isn't prepared.
Yeah.
For whatever reason.
Yes. Thank you for that. I don't know your situation well enough to be able to say anything on that, but I think sometimes clergy don't see what the experience of lay people in the church really is, or they don't hear it. I think priests need to be very careful about, I think. But thank you for that. I think we've probably come to the end of our time tonight, haven't we? So thank you very much for coming this evening. We'll be carrying on tomorrow. If you're very welcome to come along tomorrow evening, we'll do another little look at some of these things. So thank you very much.